For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, so last night, hopefully we were all here to hear Dennis lay out why we need to be talking about identity in the first place. I'm sure one of those 36 questions applied to you, if not all of them. And so he's kind of set things up for the weekend, shown us why this is a relevant question for us to be focusing on this weekend. And so this morning, Gary, Slim, and I are going to be going through some of these false sources of identity and what the ramifications of those sources are when we take our identity from them. And so between the three of us, I'm sure we'll hit your favorite area at some point this morning. And I'm going to be talking about what happens when you go inward. What happens when I'm left just to my own devices, my own resources, and my own capabilities? That's what I'm going to be talking about, and some things that I'm an expert in, fear and cynicism. So I'm just going to open us up with a word of prayer, and then we'll get talking about this. Well, Father, we really need to get under your grace right now. Pray that you would really help us stand firm in what you say is true about us. And that we can take an honest look, God, about how we may have been approaching our identity in the flesh. Help us to have honesty and humility, God, and just to be reminded of the great truths that really dwarf these lies that we believe on a regular basis. Thank you that every idol in our life, every unfaithful desire we have has been paid for in full by your Son. Amen. So the first point I want us to think about when we're talking about identity and how it relates to fear and cynicism is that our identity is really revealed to us when we face moments of crisis, right? When I look into chaos, when I look into trouble, when I look into tribulation, all of a sudden it's going to become very clear where exactly my security rests. And so, you know, we can recite our Ephesians 1 and Romans 8:1 and know all of our verses that we learned long ago. But when things start to get tough and the road gets a little rocky, what do I rely on? Is it those truths that God has said are true of me? Or is there something else that I turn to? And again, in the case of cynicism and identity, or cynicism and fear, our identity is self-oriented, right? I'm going within myself. I'm looking towards my own resources, my own capabilities, what I have to offer. And really, both cynicism and fear are prideful and arrogant. I'm saying that whatever God has to offer me in this situation is irrelevant. If I'm going to make it here, it's going to have to be with what I can put on the table and what I can offer. And when we have that perspective, fear and cynicism are very logical conclusions that we can come to. When we're fearful, what are we saying? We're saying no one, not even God, will tend to my needs and problems. I'm utterly alone. Ultimately, I've got to take care of this for myself. And I can't trust God to come through. And when we're cynical, we're saying no one, not even God, sees things how they really are like I do, right? I got the angle on this. No one else here is willing to admit that this is completely pointless and hopeless, but I see it. And both of these mentalities, okay, of I'm on my own, I can't rely on anybody else, any help I'm gonna get is gonna come from within. This is what Paul Miller calls in his book, A Praying Life, an orphan mentality. This idea that I have basically been abandoned, even by God himself, and I have got to fight and fend for myself. And the only resources are available to me are the resources that I myself possess. And the fact of the matter is that we are not orphans. We are children of God. And that's going to be something that unfolds in more depth this weekend. But for our purposes this morning, the point that I want to make is when we buy into fear, when we buy into cynicism, as the two are related, what that does is that jettisons our ability to act with boldness and confidence that we would otherwise experience if we were secure in the Lord. And I want to talk more about these issues by turning to a pretty familiar passage that I'm sure all of us have read and taught before, 1 Samuel 17. So why go to David and Goliath when talking about fear and cynicism? Well, just because I think it illustrates through a series of contrasts these principles we're talking about. That when crisis comes, how will you respond? Will you respond with cynicism? With fear? I think those come out in this story. Or with the kind of bravery and confidence that we see exhibited in David. So let's read some here. Saul and the Israelites assembled and camped in the valley of Elah and drew up their battle line to meet the Philistines. The Philistines occupied one hill and the Israelites another, with a valley between them. A champion named Goliath, who was from Gath, came out of the Philistine camp, and he was over 9 feet tall. This is a big guy. Goliath stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? And are you not the servants of Saul? Choose a man and have him come down to me. If he is able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects. But if I overcome him and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us." Then the Philistine said, "This day I defy the ranks of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight each other." And so Goliath is a problem. He's this huge, creepy, massive giant of a man. With this, you know, with this get up and these weapons, and he's like, "I'm ready to go, Israel. Send some sucker out and let's do this." And this is going to be interesting for us to know as we read through the passage here. How do different people respond to Goliath when they see a problem that is clearly beyond themselves? How do they respond? What do they do? Well, on hearing the Philistines' words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. They're a little freaked out. Understandably, right? You got the jolly green giant out there with these weapons ready to take on whoever you send first. He's angry, and he's going to take them out. What are you going to do? They're terrified. That word dismayed means to be broken. It means to be pulverized, shattered into pieces. We have no hope. Is all they could think. And for 40 days, the Philistine came forward every morning and evening and took his stand. So over and over again, he's coming out and taunting them for 40 days. This problem is not going away. Early in the morning, so Jesse sends David, because his brothers are fighting, right? He's like, "Here, take this food to your brothers over there." And David left the flock with a shepherd, loaded up, and set out as Jesse had directed. He reached the camp as his army was going out to its battle positions, shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines were drawing up their lines facing each other. David left his things with the keeper of supplies, ran to the battle lines, and greeted his brothers. As he was talking with them, Goliath, the Philistine champion from Gath, stepped out from his lines and shouted his usual defiance, and David heard it. When the Israelites saw the man, they all ran from him in great fear. Now the Israelites had been saying, "Do you see how this man keeps coming out? He comes out to defy Israel. The king will give great wealth to the man who kills him. He will also give him his daughter in marriage and will exempt his father's family from taxes in Israel." And so David shows up, and what does he see? He sees God's army fleeing in fear. Even though Saul was obviously offering this huge reward, no one was willing to do it. No one was willing to take this on. And so we see here the Israelite army responding in fear. And there's a couple things I think we can notice here about how fear affects our acting and our thinking in these circumstances. Okay, first, and Dennis pointed this out to some degree last night, fear is closely related to having a horizontal perspective, right? The two are closely related, and really they perpetuate each other, don't they? If all I'm doing is sizing things up and I've completely removed God from the equation, then I'm going to be terrified, right? And that's what they were doing. They were looking at this thinking, that guy is big and scary. He's like twice the size of us. There's no way we can do this. We have no hope. Our best bet is to hide out and hope he just goes away. Right? They have this complete horizontal perspective. And we also maybe have had a horizontal perspective before where we look at maybe the things that God's calling us to do. Hey, go witness to your neighbor. Hey, go have this really uncomfortable conversation. Hey, time to confess that sin problem. And we think, ugh, I can't do that. This is beyond me. I don't have the resources, God, to do that. And here's the thing, we're right. We don't. Anytime we try to do anything that's spiritually significant and we've subtracted God from the equation, our response is always going to be to crouch back in fear. And because of that, this fear is also immobilizing, right? It's paralyzed them. They're sitting there, God's army, the people of Yahweh, who have seen him provide time and time again miracles throughout the ages, and all they can do is hide. They can't move. They can't do it. I mean, this has been going on for 40 days. Every morning, every evening, the taunting would come. And even though Saul was offering this great reward, I'll give you wealth, you can marry my daughter, so you'll be connected to the royal family, I'll exempt you from taxes. I mean, he was like serious about this. He was like, whatever it takes. And he couldn't get any takers. No one was interested. Totally frozen. And again, this happens with us too. Maybe you've been in a situation where you know that you need to go have a conversation with somebody. God, the Lord's put that on your heart. Go talk to your neighbor about Christ. Go confront this person. Go confess the sin. Whatever. You got to go have a conversation. But every time you see the person, all the excuses come. Well, you know, I can tell that they have a lot on their plate right now. I'm just not going to bother them. Or, Lord, I've just had such a tough day at work, and I'm short on sleep, and I'm just not in any position right now. Or, you know, I need to make more of an emotional investment with this person. And we come up with any number of excuses, right, for why we don't need to act right now. I don't need to. And essentially, we've become paralyzed. Because at the end of the day, what's going on with fear, what's going on with Israel here, what happens with us is this sense of God cannot be trusted. I'm going to mistrust him. Why would I believe him? He won't do what he says. Think about Israel. Here they are. Think about the promises that God had given them before they even reached this moment. Okay, we look at Deuteronomy 20. When you go to war, the Lord says, against your enemies and see horses and chariots and an army greater than yours, do not be afraid of them, because the Lord your God, who brought you up out of Egypt, will be with you. Do not be faint-hearted or afraid. Do not be terrified or give way to panic before them. For the Lord your God is the one who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies to give you victory. God says, when this happens, not if this happens, okay, this is going to happen. You're going to face an enemy that is so much more than you can handle. And when that happens, don't become faint-hearted. Know that I'm going with you. Know that you are not alone. Know that the victory will come because of me. And Israel, I mean, they must have looked at this and thought, yeah, right. Like, we can believe that's going to happen. And a lot of times, I think when we feel that way, when we start to question these promises God's made to us, we look at the problem, we're like, you don't understand how big this problem is, God. You don't understand how tall and scary and violent this Goliath character is. You don't understand how difficult my home church is. You don't understand how unwilling my disciple is. You don't understand the kind of history between me and my spouse when it comes to these problems. And God's like, no, I get it. And I'm bigger than that. May I remind you that I did raise Jesus from the dead, right? He's like, I'm used to doing miracles. but we don't believe them. And where that unbelief takes us a lot of the times, I think, is this kind of like anxious need for control. Because once you take God out of the equation and you say he can't be trusted, he's not going to come through, all of a sudden, I put myself in a situation where I kind of got to act like God. Because if he's not going to take care of it, if God's not going to worry about this, surely someone ought to be worrying about this. And who better than me? I'm good at worrying about stuff, right? And I don't know, I think probably a lot of you here have picked up that Paul Miller book, A Praying Life, but he has some things to say about anxiety that I thought were pretty insightful. He says, anxiety wants to be God, but lacks God's wisdom, power, or knowledge. A God-like stance without God-like character and ability is pure tension. So, as it turns out, when you're not God and you're pretending to be God, that's hard. That's really hard. Because anxiety is self on its own. It tries to get control. It is unable to relax in the face of chaos. Once a problem is solved, the next in line steps up. The new one looms so large, we forget the last deliverance. Every evening when Goliath would go back, they'd be like, finally, that's over. Wouldn't be too long before he'd be showing up right there the next morning. And that's how anxiety is. We cannot be God. And we can just be consumed all the time trying to micromanage and control the things that bring fear into our own hearts. And his book, Encounter with Spurgeon, Tillich says this. He says, nervousness is sinful. It is, so to speak, the psychopathological form of unbelief. That is the truth. It leads to craziness. Sometimes you just feel like you're completely insane, which takes over too much responsibility itself, and to the same degree loses us confidence that God reigns and is looking after his cause. Man, I know that I stand up here as someone that has a very live and active struggle in this area. I do not pretend at all to have completely trumped this, figured this out in my life. God's given me some deliverance, but it's still a struggle. And I think about times when it was at its worst, okay? And I did feel like I was completely insane. This anxiety in me, it manifests in insomnia. I like lose the ability to sleep. And I remember especially when I took on more of a sphere role, a leadership role in our college and high ministry, I kind of became this crazy person. And it's really hard to make decisions about what's true and what's not when it's like 5 o'clock in the morning and you haven't slept in 2 days, right? Your reasoning skills are not all there. And, you know, it's interesting. Jesus says, who of you thinks you can add a single hour to your life through worry? What is it that you think you're accomplishing? And what God really showed me through that time of intense anxiety a few years back is that I think I'm accomplishing so much through this. I think that, you know, if I really step out and believe what God is saying and trust him, that's risky. But me not sleeping and obsessing and trying to think through all these different possibilities, I'm a failure, everyone's going to see I'm a fraud, this is just going to confirm exactly what I've always known about myself, God just put me in a position like this so I could fail, that kind of just total dark lies. It's fun to believe them. It's sick, it's perverse, but there's something about having that control and having my hooks in, that anxiety, that I get off on, right? I can say, oh, at least I have this going for me. And to release that and give that over to God. You can see why this is so immobilizing. What is it that we think we're gaining? What is it that we think we are accomplishing through this fear and this anxiety for control in our lives? We look at Israel and they were paralyzed. They could do nothing. And there are a lot of us here who maybe we're in a situation where God's put some scary risks in front of us. Maybe he's calling us to step up. And maybe we're sitting here this morning knowing that we're paralyzed. that we're ignoring it, that we're coming up with excuses, that we're just not ready yet. And maybe now's the time to take the gaze from inside of yourself and back to the God that you're dealing with. But fear wasn't the only response that kind of came up in this account in 1 Samuel 17. Let's read on. David asked the men standing near him, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel?" David's like, "Dude, what are you guys doing? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? We're talking about God. Well, let's deal with this." They repeated to him what they had been saying to him and told, "This is what will be done for the man who kills them." So they're like, "Well, the king said he'll do this. Maybe you want to do this, right?" And then Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard him speaking with the men. He burned with anger at him and asked, "Why have you come down here? And with whom did you leave those few sheep in the desert? I know how conceited you are. I know how wicked your heart is. You came down only to watch the battle." "Now what have I done?" said David. "Can't I even speak?" He then turned away to someone else and brought up the same matter. And the men answered him as before. And so Eliab's like, "I got you figured out, David. Don't try to pull one over on me. You just showed up because you want to see us make fools of ourselves. You want to see the bloodshed and the action. Go take care of your sheep." Right? This is cynicism, right? This kind of total suspicion of God and others. "I got you pegged down, David. You wicked, deceitful, conceited guy." He thinks he's got it all figured out, right? Just totally misanthropic. "I don't trust you. Don't think for a second that I'm going to put myself on the line for you." And that same attitude about other people, we apply that to God. God cannot be trusted. He's probably devising some kind of plan to complicate my life so he can call it breaking or something, right? I know how that spiritual maturity works. Not interested. And with this comes a sort of paranoia, right? We're like, and again, this is how I am. When I'm really feeding into my own cynicism, I'm like paranoid. It's like people are like trying to serve me, and I'm like, "What do you want? What are you doing that for?" Someone's like trying to help and come alongside me, and I'm like, "You're just doing this because you want to destroy me." Like that's their goal in life or something. We offer a prayer and it comes true and we're like, "It probably would have just happened anyway. This prayer stuff, I don't even know if it works." And we look at God's blessings in our life and we're like, "It's only a matter of time. He probably just gave me that so it would suck more when it's gone." And I mean, it's like, where is this coming from? And really what this is cynicism is a delusional elitism. Now, as cynics, we prefer to call this discerning realism. That's our preferred term. But honestly, it's kind of delusional. And we're being elitist. We're taking the position of superiority. We're saying, "We have the angle. We have it figured out. Eliab, David, I know exactly what's going on." Eliab was wrong, right? That becomes clear as we go through the story. He was wrong. And yet there's this confidence, this total like, "I know what's going on here." You know, and it's completely based in what? It's on the basis of, I got to protect myself. I got to expect the worst so that I'm not going to be disappointed. Again, in the book of Praying Life by Paul Miller, he has a whole chapter on cynicism. And he says, cynicism begins with the wry assurance that everyone has an angle. Behind every silver lining is a cloud. The cynic is always observing, critiquing, but never engaging, loving, and hoping. We've moved from a Promethean age of great deeds to a listless, detached age. And that's what cynicism does. It allows me to detach myself. I can be completely disengaged. I can just, you know, wall myself up and be protected. But with that comes a skewed perspective. I'm not seeing things clearly. I'm not engaged enough. I'm not attached enough to really get the full picture. And then Miller goes on to quote Yoani Sanchez, a 30-something old Cuban blogger, and he really likes what she says, and I did too. It kind of felt like this kind of paints a picture of our society now. Unlike our parents, we never believed in anything. Our defining characteristic is cynicism, but that's a double-edged sword. It protects you from crushing disappointment, but it paralyzes you from doing anything. And cynicism, it's hip, it's cool, it's what people buy into in our culture right now. And it's easy, it looks attractive, you can be totally protected, yeah, nothing, not disappointed, but the result is what? You don't do anything. You don't accomplish anything. And so we kind of end up right where we ended up with fear, right? It's just immobilizing. Here's Eliab, who's got David all figured out, right? He's got him pegged. What has he been doing for 40 days? Not me. I'm not going out there. You know, for 40 days, he's been doing nothing. He's been just as immobilized as the rest of them, despite his superior, cynical perspective. And, you know, the thing about fear and cynicism is that they become, you know, as we've seen, they become these reasons not to act. And yet, that is exactly what God has called us to do. He's called us to act. In fact, if we look throughout Scripture, all over the place, more than any other command, what do we say? We see God say, don't fear. Be courageous. There is a scriptural call for us to be bold and confident, to be brave and confident. And fear and cynicism are antithetical to that call. When I'm afraid and when I'm cynical, I don't have to be courageous. I can't. I don't have to step out in faith. And, you know, this call for us to be brave, for us to be confident, to be bold, what is that related to in Scripture? Is it because you guys are totally adequate for this job? No. It's related to who God is and our relationship to Him. And you see it all over the place in the Old Testament, but even in the New Testament. You look at John 16:33, where Jesus said, these things I've spoken to you so that in me, not in yourselves, in me, you may have peace. In the world you have tribulation, but take courage. I have overcome the world. There's no reason for you to be afraid. I've overcome the world. Christ is the ultimate conqueror. And in him, we can take courage. We can have that peace in the midst of chaos in our lives. 2 Corinthians 5. Now he who prepared us for this very purpose is God, who gave to us the Spirit as a pledge. Therefore, being always of good courage and knowing that while we are at home in the body, we are absent from the Lord. It's like, what are we living for anyway? We're living for eternity. And God himself has given us that pledge. He's given us that Spirit. His own Spirit. He spared nothing. He's put it inside of us. And he said, this is how you can know the hope that you have in me in the future. If we've been giving everything, if we've been given everything like this, what do we have to be afraid of? What do we have to lose? And so we begin to see a different picture here, a different option for how we can respond, right? We don't have to be immobilized by our fear and cynicism. We don't have to be trapped by that. And instead, we can take a stance of bravery like David did. And we're short on time. You're hearing from a lot of people this morning, so I'm just going to skip part of the story. This is what happens. I'm sure you remember. David goes to Saul and is like, so I'm going to go fight this guy. And Saul's like, you're crazy. And he's like, no, seriously, God has enabled me to beat up a bear and a lion before. And he's like, wow, you should take my armor. And he's like, I can't wear this. I'm going to go get us some stones and a slingshot. And so he goes down And he's ready, right? He's like convinced, God is with me. I'm going to go do this. And Goliath shows up. Meanwhile, the Philistine with his shield bearer in front of him kept coming closer to David. He looked David over and saw that he was only a boy, ruddy and handsome, strange detail, and he despised him. He's like, what's with this heartthrob teenager showing up here? I despise this kid. He said to David, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. He said, come here, and I'll give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field. He's like, are they serious? I'm out here for 40 days, and they send me this guy? Oh, this is going to be too easy. Let's just do this, David. I'm ready. And what David says is so remarkable. Let's not let it escape us. David said to the Philistine, you come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the army of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will hand you over to me, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. Today I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds of the air and the beasts of the earth. And the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. All those gathered here will know that it is not by the sword or the spear that the Lord saves. For the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands. David says, look, Mr. Goliath, I got news for you. You are the one that should be afraid. You are the one that has messed with the wrong guy, not me. You think that, you know, I'm talking about God here, man, and you got these weapons. Do you think that matters? Do you think that that even makes a difference? These things are pointless. Your own resources, Goliath, completely irrelevant. And you, I'm sorry, friend, but game is over for you. And what's amazing about this, as David speaks, it's like he's completely forgotten who he is. The fact that he is this like inexperienced teenager, no weapons really of anything, you know, of any sort, no knowledge of combat, no expertise, no personal resources or abilities or capabilities that could somehow contribute to the situation he now faces. And he's like, that doesn't even matter. Why would I even begin there? Why would I even try to measure myself up to you? That's not the point. Who cares what I'm like? What matters is what's God like. David's security rests solely with the Lord. Why was he brave? Why was he bold? Why was he confident? Was he just a nutty teenager? No, he knew God and his relationship with God. The fact that he knew God walked beside him, that God himself had sent him in. He's like, I can stand here and know that I'm right where I need to be. And I've got God himself on my side. And David says, you know what's awesome about that? Is that when the dust settles here, the world is going to know who had victory today. And they're not going to be looking at me. It's going to be pretty clear I didn't really do this. And that's the way it should be with us too, right? When we experience the victories, when we have those moments of courage that come from somewhere we didn't even know existed within us, who gets the glory? The Lord. And David says that's what's going to happen. He knew that promise of Deuteronomy 20. He knew the Lord was with him. And as we think too this weekend about the promises that God has made to us, the thing we need to think about is how much does that matter to you? How much is it worth that God has made you his child, that he's put his spirit within you, that he's called you valuable, that he's lavished every spiritual blessing on you? How much does that matter? I know it's easy when you look at your own problems and you think, I get it, I'm, you know, identity, I know, but this thing over here, there's no buts. There's no but this thing over here when we're talking about how you have been put into Christ. Period. We need to be thinking about those promises and what God has said to us. And that's something that Les is going to unpack more tonight. But in the meantime, I think that we can see that we have every reason to say along with Paul in 2 Corinthians 3, such confidence as this is ours through Christ before God. Not that we are competent in ourselves to claim anything for ourselves, but our competence comes from God. And so I'm sure, hopefully the Lord has pressed something onto your heart this morning where you know you've been cowering away, when you've been hiding out in your cynicism. And maybe it's time to think about what it would look like to be brave in the Lord's adequacy and the Lord's competence in that area. So I'm going to end there. And we're going to bring up Scott now. And he is going to talk about, him and Gary are going to talk about some of the more external false sources of identity.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.